the face by itself to examine it. Maybe, he said after a minute. Maybe Mexican or Central American? Not Puerto Rican or Cuban, I'd guess. He looks like he might have a lot of mestizo in him, or he might be Native American. What tribe? No clue, Diaz said. Ethnic typing's not actually my gig. By this time, Van had gone over to the image of the corpse and was looking at the hands. Diaz, Van said. Do we have a broken glass in evidence? Yes, Diaz said after checking. Shane got an image of it from under the bed. Pull it up for me, please. The image of the room spun wildly as Diaz yanked it around, pulling us all under the bed and looming the image of the shattered, bloody glass over us. Fingerprints, Van said, pointing. Do we have any idea whose they are? Nothing yet, Diaz said. What are you thinking? I asked Van. She ignored me again. You have the feed from Officer Timmons? She asked Diaz. Yeah, but it's pretty crappy and low res, Diaz said. God damn it, I told Trin I wanted everything, Van said. She might not be holding out on you, Diaz said. Metro cops these days let their feeds run their whole shift sometimes. If they do that, they use a low-res setting because it lets them record longer. Whatever, Van said, still clearly annoyed. Put it up for me and overlay it onto Shane's room shot. The room wheeled around again and went back to its real-world dimensions. Feed coming up, Diaz said. It's going to be in bas-relief because of Timmons's position. I cleaned up the jerkiness. On the bed, Bell appeared, hands up. The feed started running in real time. Wait, Van said, pause it. Done, Diaz said. Can you get a clearer image of Bell's hands? Not really, Diaz said. I can blow it up, but it's a low-res feed. It's got inherent limitations. Blow it up, Van said. Bell jerked and grew large, his hands racing toward us like a giant trying to play patty cake. Shane, Van said. Tell me what you see. I looked at the hands for a couple moments, not seeing whatever it was that I was supposed to be seeing. Then it occurred to me that not seeing a thing was what Van was going for. No blood, I said. Right, Van said. She pointed. He's got blood on his shirt and his face, but none on his hands. The broken glass has bloody finger marks all over it. Diaz, pull back out. The image zoomed out again, and Van went over to the corpse. This guy, though, has blood all over his hands. This dude cut his own throat? I asked. Possible, Van said. That's genuinely bizarre, I said. Then this isn't a murder, it's a suicide, which would get Bell off the hook. Maybe. Van said, give me other options. Bell could have done it and cleaned up before hotel security got there, I said. There's still the bloody glass, Van said. We've got Bell's fingerprints on file. He had to give them when he became a licensed integrator. Maybe he was interrupted, I said. Maybe, Van said. She didn't sound convinced. An idea popped into my brain. Diaz, I said, I'm sending over a file. Pop it up as soon as you get it, please. Got it, Diaz said, a couple of seconds later. 2 seconds after that, the scene shifted to outside of the Watergate, to the hurled love seat and the crushed car. What are we looking for? Van asked. It's what we're not looking for, I said. It's the same thing we weren't looking for on Bell's hands. Blood, Van said, and looked closely at the love seat. There's no blood on the love seat. Not that I can see, I said. So there's a good chance the love seat went out the window before our corpse cut his own throat. It's a theory, Van said, but why? She pointed to the corpse. This guy contracts with Bell to integrate. And then when Bell gets there, he throws a love seat out of the window and then commits bloody suicide in front of him? Why? Throwing a love seat out of a 7th-story window is a pretty good way to get the attention of the hotel security staff, I said. He wanted to frame Bell for his murder, and this was a way to make sure security would already be on their way before he killed himself. It still doesn't answer the question of why he'd commit suicide in front of Bell in the first place, Van said. She looked back down at the corpse. "Well, we do know one thing," I said. "Bell was maybe telling the truth when he said he didn't do it." "That's not what he said," Van said. "I think it was. I saw the feed." "No," Van said, and turned back to Diaz. "Run the Timmons feed again." The image snapped once more to the hotel room, and the bas-relief of Bell reappeared. Diaz set it running. Timmons asked Bell why he killed the man in the room. Bell responded that he didn't think he did. "Stop it," Van said. Diaz stopped the feed just as Timmons zapped Bell. He was frozen mid-spasm. "He didn't say he didn't kill him," Van said to me. "He said he didn't think he killed him. He's saying he didn't know." A light went on in my head, and I remembered my one personal experience with an integrator. "That's not right." "Integrators are conscious for their sessions," Van said, nodding. "They subsume and stay in the background during integration, but they're allowed to surface if the client needs help or is about to do something outside the scope of the integration session." "Or is about to do something stupid or illegal," I said, "which is usually outside the scope of the session," Van pointed out. "Okay," I said, and motioned back to the corpse. "But what does it matter? If this guy is a suicide, then Bell telling us he doesn't think he did it doesn't tell us anything we don't know. Because now we're thinking that maybe he didn't do it either." Van shook her head. "It's not about whether this is a murder or a suicide. It's about the fact Bell says he can't remember. He's supposed to be able to remember." "That's if he's integrated," I said. "But we think he came to the room to pick up this side job, right? In which case, there was no one else in his brain when he allegedly blacked out." "Why would he black out?" Van asked. "I don't know, maybe he's a drinker." "He doesn't look drunk on the feed," Van said. "He didn't smell or act like he'd been drinking when I questioned him. And anyway," she fell silent again. "Are you going to be doing a lot of that?" I asked her, "because I can already tell it's going to bug me." "Schwartz said Bell was working," Van said. "That client integrator privilege applied." "Right," I said, and motioned to the corpse. "That's his client." "That's just it," Van said. "He's not a client." "I'm not following you." "Integration is a licensed and regulated practice," Van said. "You take on clients and you have certain professional obligations to them, but only a certain class of person is allowed to be your clientele. Only Haydens are supposed to be clients of integrators. This guy," she indicated the corpse, "is a tourist. He's able-bodied." "I'm not a lawyer, but I'm not 100% behind this theory here," I said. "A priest can hear a confession from anyone, not just a Catholic, and a doctor can claim confidentiality from the second someone walks through the door. I think Schwartz is probably making the same claim here. Just because the dude's a tourist doesn't mean he's not a client. He is, just like someone who's not Catholic can still confess." "Or Schwartz slipped up and let us know that someone was writing Bell," Van said. "That doesn't make any sense," I countered. "If Bell was already integrated, then why would he be meeting with a tourist? Maybe they were meeting for something else." "Then why bring that?" I pointed to the headset. Van was silent for a minute. "Not all my theories are going to be gold," she said, eventually. "I get that," I said, dryly. "But I don't think it's you. None of this makes much sense. We've got a murder that probably isn't, of a man we haven't ID'd, who had a meeting with an integrator who may have already been integrated, who says he can't remember things he should. That's a mess right there." "Your thoughts," Van said. "Shit, I don't know," I said. "It's my second day on the job, and already it's gotten too weird for me." "You guys gotta wrap it up," Diaz said. "I got another agent who needs the room in 5. Van nodded at this and turned back to me. "Let me put it another way," she said. "What are our action items?" I looked over to Diaz. "Any matches on our corpse yet?" "Nothing yet," Diaz said after a second. "That's a little weird. It doesn't usually take this long to process a match." "Our first action item is to find out who our dead guy is," I said to Van, "and how he's managed not to have any sort of impression on our national database." "What else?" "Find out what Bell's been up to recently and who is on his client list. Maybe that'll pop up something interesting." "All right," Van said. "I'll take the stiff." Oh, sure, I said. You get the fun gig. Van smiled at this. I'm sure Bell will be tons of fun. Do I need to be here while I'm doing this? I asked. Why? Van asked. Do you have a date? Yes, with a realtor, I said. I'm looking at apartments. Federally approved. Technically, I'm supposed to have a half day today for it. Don't expect too many more of those, Van said. Half days, I mean. Yeah, I said. I'm kind of figuring that out on my own. Chapter 5. The realtor was a small, elegant-looking woman named Latasha Robinson, and she met me directly outside the Bureau building. One of her realty specialties was the Hayden Market, so the Bureau connected me with her to help me find an apartment. Given her clientele, the chances that she might not know who I was were close to nil, a suspicion that was verified as I approached. She smiled a smile I recognized from years of being trotted out as the official Hayden's poster child, part of the official Hayden's poster family. I didn't hold it against her. Agent Shane, she said, holding out her hand. Really lovely to meet you. I took the hand and shook it. Ms. Robinson, likewise. I'm sorry, this is kind of exciting, she said. I don't meet that many famous people. I mean, who aren't politicians? Not in this town, no, I agreed. And I don't think of politicians as being famous. Do you? They're just politicians. I couldn't agree more, I said. My car's right over here, she said, pointing to a relatively unflashy Cadillac parked where it would get ticketed. Why don't we get started? I got into the passenger side. Robinson got in the driver's seat and pulled out her tablet. Amble, she said, and the car slid out from the curb, just ahead, I noted as I glanced in the rearview mirror, of a traffic cop. We headed east on Pennsylvania Avenue. The car's just going to drive around for a few minutes while we get set up here, Robinson said, tapping her tablet. For all her gushing a few seconds before, she slipped into business mode pretty quickly. I've got your basic request list and personal information. She looked over as if to acknowledge I was, in fact, a Hayden, and she knew it. So let's get a few things narrowed down before we start. All right, I said. How close do you want to be to work? Closer is better. Are we talking walking distance close or metro line close? Metro line close is fine, I said. Do you prefer a neighborhood that's hip or one that's quiet? It doesn't really matter to me. You say that now. But if I get you an apartment over a bar in Adams Morgan and you hate it, you're going to blame me, Robinson said, looking over at me. I promise noise isn't going to bother me, I said. I can turn down my hearing. Do you plan on using the apartment to socialize? Not really, I said. I do most of my socializing elsewhere. I might have a friend over from time to time. Robinson looked over again at this and seemed to be considering whether to ask for clarification and decided against it. It was a fair call. There were three fetishists out there. They really weren't my thing, I have to say. Will your body be physically present, and if so, will you need a room for a caretaker? She asked. My body and its caretaking are already squared away, I said. I won't be needing space for either, at least not right away. In that case, I have some Hayden efficiency flats on my availability list, she said. Would you like to see those? Are they worth my time? I asked. Robinson shrugged. Some Haydens like them, she said. I think they're a little small, but then they're not designed for non-Haydens. Are they close by? I've got a building of them on D Avenue in Southwest, right by the Federal Center Metro, Robinson said. The Department of Health and Human Services hires a lot of Haydens, so it's convenient housing for them. All right, I said, we might as well check them out. We'll go there first, Robinson said, and spoke the address to the Cadillac. 5 minutes later, we were in front of a depressing slab of anonymous, brutalist architecture. This is lovely, I said dryly. I think it used to be a government office building, Robinson said. They converted it about 20 years ago. It was one of the first buildings redesigned with Hayden's in mind. She nodded me into the lobby, which was clean and plain. A Threep receptionist sat behind a desk. The Threep was set to transmit ID data over the common channel. In my field of vision, its owner's data popped up above the Threep's head. Genevieve Tourneau, 27 years old, native of Rockville, Maryland, her public address for direct messages. Hello, Robinson said to Genevieve and showed her her realtor's ID. We're here to look at the vacancy on the fifth floor. Genevieve turned to look at me, and I realized belatedly that I didn't have my own personal data out on the common channel. Some Haydens found that rude. I quickly popped it up. She gave me a quick nod as if in acknowledgement, did a small double take, then recovered and turned her attention to Robinson. Unit 503 is unlocked for the next 15 minutes, she said.
Thank you,
Robinson said, and nodded over to me. Hold on a second, I said. I turned back to Genevieve. May I have guest access to the building channel, please? Genevieve nodded to me, and I saw the channel marker pop up in my view. I connected to it. The lobby walls exploded into signage. Some of the notes were your basic corkboard notes, people looking for roommates or to sublet or asking after lost pets. At the moment, however, signs about the walkout and march dominated. Signs reminding tenants to stay home, plans for walkout activities, requests to let Haydens coming into town for the march crash in apartments with the sardonic notation that they won't need much space.
Everything okay? Robinson asked.
It's fine, I said. I'm just taking in the posters on the wall. I read a few more, and then we walked over to the elevator bank and took the next lift up to the fifth floor.
Extra-large elevators, Robinson noted as we rose.
Hydraulic lift. Makes it easier to bring bodies up to the rooms. I thought these were all efficiency apartments, I said.
Not all of them, Robinson said. Some of them are full-sized and have dedicated medical suites and caretaker rooms, and even the efficiencies have cradle hookups.
Those are supposed to be used on a temp basis, although I hear some Haydens are using them full-time now. Why is that? I asked. The elevator stopped and the doors opened.
Abrams Kettering, Robinson said.
She walked out of the lift and down the hall. I followed.
Assistance is getting slashed, so a lot of Haydens are downsizing. Those in townhomes are moving into smaller apartments. Those in apartments are moving into efficiencies, and some of those in efficiencies are taking on roommates. They're using the chargers in shifts.
She glanced back to me, and her eyes flickered over my shiny, expensive threep, as if to say, not that you have to worry about that.
It's been bad for the market, to be honest, but that's good for you as a potential renter. Now you have a lot more options, a lot cheaper.
She stopped at apartment 503. That is, if this doesn't bowl you over. She opened the door and stood aside to let me pass through. Hayden Efficiency Apartment 503 was 2 meters by 3 meters and entirely bare, save for one small built-in countertop. I stepped inside and immediately got claustrophobia.
This isn't an apartment, it's a closet, I said, stepping forward to let Robinson in.
I usually think of it as a bathroom, Robinson said, and pointed to a small tiled area which had a bank of electrical outlets and a couple of covered drains on the floor, flush with the tile.
That's the medical nook, by the way, right where the toilet would be.
You're not exactly giving me the hard sell on this apartment, Ms. Robinson, I said.
Well, to be fair, if all you're looking to do is park your threep every night, this isn't a bad choice, Robinson said.
She pointed to the back right corner, where grooves and high-voltage outlets were set into the wall, ready to receive inductive chargers.
It's designed with standard threep cradles in mind, and the hardwired and wireless networks are fast and have deep throughput. The space has been designed with threeps in mind, so you don't have inessential things taking up space like closets and sinks. It's everything you need and absolutely nothing you don't.
I hate it, I said.
I thought you might, Robinson said. That's why I showed it to you first. Now that we have it out of the way, we can look at something you might actually be interested in.
I stared back at the spot of tile and thought about putting a human body there, more or less permanently.
These kinds of apartments are hot right now? I asked.
They are, Robinson said.
I don't usually deal with them. Not enough commission on these. They usually get rented through online want ads. But yes, right now this kind of apartment is selling like hotcakes.
Now I'm feeling a little depressed, I said.
You don't have to feel depressed, Robinson said. You're not going to live here. You're not going to have your body in here.
But apparently some people are, I said.
Yes, Robinson said. Maybe it's a blessing the bodies don't notice.
Ah, but that's not true, I said. We're locked in, not unconscious. Trust me, Ms. Robinson, we notice where our bodies are. We notice it every moment we're awake. I felt like Goldilocks for the next several stops. The apartments were either too small, we didn't look at any more apartments that were officially efficiencies, but a couple were at least informally around the same square footage, or too large, too inconvenient, or too far away. I began to despair that I would be destined to store my threep at my desk at the bureau. Last stop of the day, Robinson said. By now, even her professional cheeriness was wearing through. We were in Capitol Hill, on Fifth Street, looking at a red townhouse. What's here? I asked. Something off the usual menu, Robinson said. But it's something I think you might be a good fit for. Do you know what an intentional community is? Intentional community, I said. Isn't that another way of saying commune? I looked up at the townhouse. This is a weird place for a commune. It's not exactly a commune, Robinson said. This townhouse is rented out by a group of Haydens living together and sharing the common rooms. They call it an intentional community because they share responsibilities, including monitoring each other's bodies. That's not always a great idea, I said. One of them is a doctor at the Howard University Hospital, Robinson said. If there's any substantial problem, there's someone on hand to deal with it. I understand it's not something you'll need, of course, but there are other advantages, and I know they have a vacancy. How do you know these people? I asked. Robinson smiled. My son's best friend lives here, she said. Ah, I said. Did your son live here too? You're asking if my son is a Hayden, Robinson said. No, Damien is unaffected. Tony, Damien's friend, contracted Haydens when he was 11. I've known Tony all his life, before and after Haydens. He lets me know when they have a vacancy. He knows I won't bring over anyone I don't think would be a good fit. And you think I would be a good fit? I think you might be. I've been wrong before. But you're a special case, I think. If you don't mind me saying so, Agent Shane, you're not looking for a place because you need a place. You're looking for a place because you want a place. That's about right, I said. Robinson nodded. So I thought I would let you look at this and see if it's something you want. Okay, I said. Let's take a look. Robinson went to the door and rang the bell. A threep opened it and threw its arms wide when it saw her. Mama Robinson, it said, and gave her a big hug. Robinson gave the threep a peck on the cheek. Hello, Tony, she said. I brought you a prospect. Did you? Tony said, and looked over to me. Chris Shane, he said. I was momentarily surprised. I didn't think my new threep was that well known already, but then I remembered I had turned on my public ID earlier in the day. A second later, Tony's own ID popped up. Tony Wilton, 31, originally from Washington, D.C. Hi, I said. He waved us in. Let's not keep you standing on the stoop, he said. Come on, Chris, I'll show you the room. It's up on the second floor. He led us inside and up the stairs. As we walked down the second floor hall, I glanced into one of the rooms. A body lay in a cradle, monitors nearby. I looked over to Tony, who saw me looking. Yep, that's me, he said. Sorry, I said, reflex. Don't be sorry, Tony said, opening up the door to another room. If you live here, you'll do your time checking in on all of us to make sure we're still breathing. Might as well get used to it. Here's the room. He stood aside to let me and Robinson in. The room was large, modestly but comfortably appointed, with a window facing out to the street. This is really nice, I said, looking around. Glad you like it, Tony said. He nodded to the furniture. The room's furnished, obviously, but if you don't like what you see here, we have basement storage to put it in. No, it's fine, I said, and I like the size of it. It's actually the biggest bedroom in the house. None of the rest of you wanted it? I asked. It's not a question of wanting it, Tony said. It's a question of affording it. Got it, I said, and figured out another reason Robinson thought I might be good for this address. You understand what the setup here is? Tony asked. Mama Robinson explained it to you? Briefly, I said. It's not really that complicated, I promise, Tony said. We share chores and monitoring duties, make sure everyone's tubes and drains are in working order, pool funds for house improvements. Occasionally, we go out as a group and do social things. We call it an intentional community, but it's more like a college dorm, just less drinking and smoking pot. Not that we ever did that. Also, less roommate drama, which we did do if you remember college at all. "Are you the doctor?" I asked. Ms. Robinson said one of you was a doctor. "That's Taylor," Tony said. "She's at work. Everyone's at work except me. I'm a contract coder. Today I'm working for Ginobil Systems on their brain interface software. Tomorrow, someone else. I usually work from here, unless a client needs me on site. So someone's always here." "Usually," Tony said. "Now, should I make like I don't know who you are? Or can I admit that I was reading about you in the Agora yesterday?" "Oh, joy," I said. "You'll note I said everyone is at work," Tony said, "so you're not likely to get judged for that. We have a range of political opinions in the House as it is." "So you know I'm an FBI agent," I said. "I do," Tony said. "Deal with conspiracies and murders?" "You'd be surprised," I said. "I bet I would," Tony said. "Well, I just met you, but I like you. You'll have to meet and get the approval of the others, though." "How many more of you are there?" 4, Tony said. "There's Taylor, Sam Richards, and Justin and Justine Cho. They're twins." "Interesting," I said. "They're all good folks, promise," Tony said. "Can you swing round tonight to meet them?" No, I said. "I have a family thing tonight. It's my second day on the job. I'm supposed to go home for the official hooray our kid is employed dinner." "Well, you can't miss that," Tony said. "When do you think you'll wrap up?" "I don't know," I said. "Probably 9:30, 10 at the latest." "Here." Tony pinged me over the common channel with an invite.
"Tuesdays are our group night in the Agora.
We hang out and usually frag each other's brains out in an FPS. Pop in. You can meet the crew and take a headshot or two." "Sounds good," I said. "Great. I'll send over the room application and we can do it up formally. We'll need first month and a deposit." "I can do that." "Even better," Tony said. "Presuming you get the sign-off from everyone tonight, you can move in as soon as your payment arrives." "You're not going to want a background check?" I joked. "I think your entire life has been a background check, Chris," Tony said. Chapter 6. "Oh, fuck me," I said, the minute I saw the valet at the door to my house. The painkillers from my oral extraction at 4 o'clock had started wearing off as I headed home, and that made me grumpy to begin with. But the valet meant one thing: donor dinner. Most cars could self-park, but there were still people who demanded that they had to be behind the wheel and took great pride in their dumb cars. A bunch of them were the sort of cranky old people who might support my dad's bid for senator. That made me crankier than the tooth extraction. My mother had obviously guessed my mood as I stomped up to her, because she held her hands out placatingly. "Don't blame me, Chris," she said. "I thought it was just going to be a family dinner. I had no idea your father was going to turn it into a fundraiser." "I'm skeptical," I said. "I don't blame you," she said, "but it's the truth." Behind her, catering staff laid out place settings in the formal dining room, directed by Lyle, our house supervisor. I counted out the settings. 16 settings, Mother," I said. "I know," she said. "Sorry. Where are they all?" "They're not all here yet," she said. "The ones that are down in the vet's office." "Mom," I warned. "I know I'm not supposed to say that out loud," she said. "I'll amend." "They're in the trophy room." "So it's not just the usual gang of idiots," I said. "You know your father," Mom said. "Dazzle the new money with the hardware. It would be vulgar, except for the fact that it works." "Actually, it's still vulgar," I said. "Yes, it is," Mom agreed. "And it still works." "Dad doesn't need their money to run for senator," I pointed out. "Your father needs them to believe he's invested in their interests," Mom said. "That's why he takes their money." "Yeah, that's not Machiavellian at all." "Yes, well," she said. "The things we do to get your father elected." She reached out and touched my shoulder. "And how was your day?" Interesting, I said. I'm working on a murder case, and I think I may have found an apartment.
I still don't know why you think you need an apartment, my mother said crossly.
Mom, you're the only person in the world who would have chosen my apartment hunting over a murder case as a topic of conversation.
I notice you didn't address my point, Mom said.
I sighed and held up a hand to tick off points. One, because commuting into the district from Potomac Falls every day would be a pain in the ass and you know it. Two, because I'm 27 and it's embarrassing to still live with my parents. Three, because my tolerance for being a prop for Dad's political ambitions is getting lower by the day.
That's not fair, Chris, Mom said.
Come on, Mom, I said. You know he's going to do it tonight. I'm not the 5-year-old he can trot out for congressional hearings and Hayden fundraisers. I'm a federal agent now, for God's sake. I don't think it's even legal to trot me around anymore.
I had a twinge as the painkillers stepped down another notch and held up a hand to my jaw. She caught it.
Your molar, she said.
Lack of molar, actually.
I put my hand down, fully aware of the irony of indicating jaw pain on my threep.
I'm going to go check in on myself, I said, and turned to go to my room.
When you move, you're not going to move your body, are you?
Mom asked. There was a thread of anxiousness in her voice.
I'm not planning to right now,
I said, turning back a little to look at her. Let's see how it works. I didn't notice any lag today, and as long as I don't, there's no reason to move.
All right, Mom said, still unhappy.
I went over and gave her a hug.
Relax, Mom, I said.
It's not a thing. I'll have the spare threep here. I'll visit. A lot. You'll start to wonder if I've actually left. She smiled at that and patted my cheek.
Normally, I'd call you on patronizing me, but this one time, I'll take it, she said.
Now, go check in on yourself. Don't take too long. Your father wants you to make an appearance before we all sit down to dinner.
Of course he does, I said.
I squeezed Mom's arm as I left.
Jerry Riggs, my new evening nurse, waved to me as I walked into my room. He was reading a hardcover book.
How you doing, Chris?
I'm in a little bit of pain, actually, I said.
Jerry nodded.
The bed sore?
He asked.
The molar extraction, I said.
Right.
Jerry set down his book and walked over to my cradle, which had conformed to let me rest on my left side because my current bed sore was on my right hip. He started rummaging through the bedside cabinet.
I have some Tylenol with codeine, Jerry said. Your dentist left it for you.
I have to be able to function this evening, I said. There's nothing more dangerous than a stoned threep at a political fundraiser.
All right, Jerry said. Let me see what else we have here.
I nodded and went over to my body. To me. I looked as I always did, like someone sleeping. My body was neat and clean, which was not always a guarantee with a Hayden. Some Haydens didn't bother with having their hair cut or trimmed because, honestly, what did it matter? My mother had quite the opposite opinion on the subject, however. As I got older, I adopted her position for my own. The cleanliness was a different and more complex issue, as it would be with a body whose various holes and systems were tubed, bagged, and catheterized. My mother was concerned about me moving out, not just because she would miss me. She was also worried that, left to my own devices and schedule, I would let myself wallow in my own filth for days on end. This was an unwarranted concern on her part, I thought. I bent over to look at my bed sore. True to advertisement, it was a nasty red welt across my hip. I touched it and felt the dull ache of it at the same time I felt my threep hand moving across it. I felt that sensation unique to Hayden's, the vertigo that comes from perceptually being in two places at once. It's much more noticeable when your body and your threep are in the same room at the same time. The technical term for it is polypropriocepcion. Humans, who generally have only one body to deal with, aren't naturally designed for it. It literally changes your brain. You can see the difference between a Hayden brain and an unaffected brain on an MRI. The vertigo happens when your brain remembers it's not supposed to be getting input from two separate bodies. The simple solution when it happens is to just look somewhere else. I turned and focused on the other me in the room, my previous threep, which was my primary threep until I got the 660. It was a Cayman Zephyr, now sitting on an inductive charger chair, a very nice model. The body was ivory with blue and gray limb accents. I did undergrad and got my master's at Georgetown, and it seemed the thing to do at the time. My current threep was an understated matte ivory with subtle maroon pinstripe accents on the limbs. I vaguely wondered if I was letting down the alma mater. "Here we go," Jerry said, and held up a small bottle. "Lidocaine should do the trick for a couple of hours. That'll get you through the dinner, and then after that, I'll put some extra-strength ibuprofen into your system. As long as you stay sense-forward on your threep, you should be fine." "Thanks," I said. "Interesting that you don't always stay fully sense-forward on your threep," Jerry said, as he prepped the lidocaine. "I don't like how it feels," I said. "If I can't feel my body, it feels off. Adrift. Weird." Jerry nodded. "I can see that, I guess," he said. "Not everyone does it that way. My last client was full sense forward on her threep all the time. Didn't like feeling what was going on with her body. Hell, didn't like actually acknowledging she had a body. She found it inconvenient, I think is the best way of putting it." Which was ultimately ironic. "How so?" "She had a heart attack and didn't even feel it," Jerry said. "She found out about it from an automated alert to her threep. We start working on her to save her, and she calls in from her threep with this pissy sort of voice, telling us that we just had to get her up and running again. She had a 3 o'clock session with her shrink that she couldn't miss." "Did she miss it?" "Yep," Jerry said. He put on a pair of gloves. "She dropped dead mid-sentence, still pissy. On one hand, she really didn't feel it, which, I suppose, isn't a bad thing. On the other hand, well, I think it came as a surprise to her that she could die. She spent so much time in her threep, I think she believed it really was her." He opened my mouth, and I could feel my jaw stretch. "Okay, you might feel a poke here for a minute." Dad's trophy room is impressive, but then that's the point. Marcus Shane isn't the kind of person to tell you he's more important than you. He's happy to let his hardware make the point for him. The west side of the room details his early basketball career. This includes his junior high and high school jerseys, the four DCI2A trophies he won for Cardozo High, and the acceptance letter he received to Georgetown University, full scholarship. Then follows a ridiculous number of photos of him in action with the Hoyas, with whom he reached the Final Four 3 times, taking the championship in his junior year. The picture of him weeping as he cuts down the net is up there, with a piece of the actual net inside the same frame. It's surrounded by the Wooden, Naismith, and Robinson Awards, which he won the same year, and his championship ring on a pillow. The sting of crashing out of the NCAA finals in the semifinal round in his senior year was ameliorated by winning an Olympic gold medal. Everyone agreed that the gold medals for his Olympiad were even uglier than usual. On the other hand, it was an Olympic gold medal, so everyone could just shut up. On to the south side of the room, and we have Dad's professional career, all of it with the Washington Wizards, into which he was drafted after a particularly abysmal 16-win season. A lot of people thought the team intentionally tanked their season to get a shot at Dad in the draft. Privately, Dad didn't credit the coach or the GM with that much strategic planning. The coach was gone by the end of Dad's first season, the GM by the second, and 2 years later, Dad drove the team into the playoffs. 2 years after that, Washington won the first of 3 back-to-back-to-back championships. This wall featured lots of photos of Dad suspended in air, his league and series MVP awards, some of the more iconic objects of his professional endorsement career, a display case with his 4 championship rings, the final one coming in his last year playing, topped off by the long, thin trophy you get when you're inducted into the Naismith Hall of Fame, which he was in his first year of eligibility. The east side of the room begins with a magazine cover while Dad was still with the Wizards, not from Sports Illustrated, but from a DC business magazine, which was the first to notice that America's hottest rookie was not buying a stupidly large house and otherwise throwing his money around like an asshole, but was instead living in a modest Alexandria townhouse and investing in real estate in and around the district. By the time Dad retired from basketball, he was making more money from his real estate company than he was from playing and endorsements, and he officially became a billionaire the same year he was inducted into the hall. This side of the room is filled with various business and real estate awards and citations. There are more of these than anything else. Business people sure like to give out awards. The north side of the room was related to Dad's philanthropy work, and specifically his work with Hayden's syndrome. A natural cause for him after his only child, me, was stricken with the disease in its first terrible wave, along with millions of others, including Margaret Hayden, the First Lady of the United States. Despite the syndrome being named after the First Lady, it was Dad and Mom, the former Jacqueline Oxford, scion of one of Virginia's oldest political families, who became the public face of Hayden's awareness. Along with me, of course. And so this wall was filled with pictures of Dad testifying before Congress for the massive research and development required to deal with 4.5 million U.S. citizens suddenly having their minds cut off from their bodies. Being present when President Benjamin Hayden signed the Hayden Research Act into law, being on the board of the Hayden Institute and of Sebring Warner Industries, which developed the first THREEPs, and being virtually present when the Agora, the virtual environment developed specifically for Haydens, was opened up for us to populate and to have a space of our own in the world. Interspersed with these photos were pictures of us, me, Mom and Dad, in various places, meeting world leaders, celebrities, and other Hayden families. I was one of the first Hayden children to own and use a THREEP, and my parents made a point of bringing me everywhere in my THREEP, not just so I could have a childhood filled with enviable personal experiences, although that was a nice side benefit. The point was to encourage the unaffected to see THREEPs as people, not freaky androids that had just popped up in their midst. Who better to do that than the child of one of the most celebrated men in the entire world? So, up until I turned 18, I was one of the most famous and photographed Haydens in the world. The photo of me handing a flower to the Pope in St. Peter's Basilica is regularly cited as one of the most famous photographs of the last half century. The image of a child-sized THREEP offering an Easter lily to the Bishop of Rome being an iconic juxtaposition of modern technology and traditional theology, one presenting a peace offering to the other, who is reaching out, smiling, to take it. When I was in college, I had a professor tell me that single image did more to advance the acceptance of Haydens as people, not victims, than 1,000 congressional testimonials or scientific discoveries could have. I told him what I remembered about the Pope was that he had wicked bad breath. I went to Georgetown. My professor was a priest. I don't think he was very happy with me. My dad had taken the photo. It was dead center, north wall. On the left side of it is his certificate for being a Pulitzer finalist for the feature photography category, which even he, to his credit, admits is kind of ridiculous. On the right side is his Presidential Medal of Freedom, given to him a couple of years back for his work with Haydens. Underneath that is the picture of him having the medal placed around his neck by President Gilchrist and bending down, laughing, so the famously short Gilchrist could manage it. 3 months later, Willard Hill was elected president. President Hill signed Abrams Kettering into law. President Hill was not thought well of in the Shane household. I've lived with the trophy room all my life, so I never thought there was anything particularly special about it. It was just another room in the house, and a boring one at that, since I wasn't allowed to play in it. And I know Dad is pretty blasé about awards at this point. Short of a Nobel Peace Prize, he's pretty much run the table. Outside of humoring visitors or hosting events, I've never seen him step foot into the trophy room. He doesn't even put things in there. He leaves that to Mom. But then, the trophy room isn't for us. It's for everyone else. My father deals with millionaires and billionaires on a daily basis, the sort of people who have egos just this side and sometimes way over the edge of sociopathy, the sort of person who thinks he's the apex predator wading through a universe of sheep. Dad takes them into the trophy room, and their eyes get to the size of dinner plates, and they realize that whatever shit they've got going on is tiddlywinks compared to Dad. There are maybe 3 people in the world more interesting than Marcus Shane. They are not one of them. Which is why Mom, when she's being indiscreet, refers to the trophy room as the vet's office. Because that's where Dad brings people to take their balls. Into the vet's office I walked, newly numb in the jaw, to see who tonight's set of financial and testicular donors were. I saw Dad instantly, of course. He's 6'8". He's hard to miss. I was not prepared for the other person I saw, standing with Dad, looking up at him, smiling, drink in hand. It was Nicholas Bell. Chapter 7.
"Chris!" Dad said, and then suddenly he was looming over me as he does to grab me in a hug. "How you doing, kiddo?"
"Being crushed by you, Dad," I said, and he laughed. This was a standard call and response for us.
"Thanks for coming in to meet people," he said.
"We have to have a talk about that," I said, "sometime really soon."
I know," he said, but then waved Bell over anyway. Bell walked over, drink in hand, still smiling. "This is Lucas Hubbard, CEO and chairman of Accelerant Investments."
"Hello, Chris," Hubbard slash Bell said, extending his hand. "It's nice to meet you." I shook it.
"And you," I said. "I'm sorry, I'm having a bit of deja vu at the moment."
Hubbard Bell smiled.
"I get that a lot," he said. He sipped from the glass,
scotch on the rocks.
"Sorry," I said. I was just surprised.
"So you know who Lucas is?" Dad said, watching our somewhat cryptic exchange.
"No, it's not that," I said. "I mean, yes, I know who Lucas Hubbard is, of course, but I also know..."
I trailed off. It was considered rude to acknowledge that an integrated Hayden was using someone else's body.
"You know the integrator I'm using," Hubbard said, sparing me the faux pas.
"Yes, that's it," I said. "We've met before."
"Socially?"
Hubbard said. "Professionally," I said. "Briefly."
"Interesting," Hubbard said.
A rather good-looking woman walked up and stood next to him. He motioned to her.
"And this is Accelerant Investments General Counsel, Samuel Schwartz."
"We've met," Schwartz said, looking directly at me.
"Have you now?" Hubbard said.
"Also professionally," I said. "Also briefly."
"Indeed," Schwartz said, and smiled. "I didn't make the connection as to who you were at first when we met, Agent Shane. I had to look you up halfway through the conversation. I do apologize."
"No apology needed," I said. "I was out of context. Speaking of which, you are looking a bit different from when I last saw you, Mr. Schwartz. It's an unexpected look."
Schwartz glanced down at his body.
"I suppose it is," he said. "I know some Haydens who enjoy cross-gender integration, but I'm not usually one of them. But my usual integrator was unavailable this evening, and I was a last-minute addition to this party, so I had to work with who was available."
"You could have done worse," I assured him. He smiled again.
"I don't know how I feel about you knowing these two better than I do," Dad said, charmingly, smoothly.
"I find it a little surprising myself," I said.
"As do I," Hubbard said. "It doesn't seem possible that your father and I haven't crossed paths before, all things considered. But then, aside from our various offices, Accelerant Investments doesn't do much in the field of real estate."
"Why is that, Lucas?" Dad asked.
"As a Hayden, I'm less engaged with the physical world, I suppose," Hubbard said. "It's just not front of mind for me." He motioned at Dad with his scotch. "I don't think you mind me not competing in your field."
"No," Dad said, "although I don't mind competition."
"That's because you're very good at beating the competition," Hubbard said.
Dad laughed. "I suppose that's true," he said.
"Of course it is," Hubbard said, then looked at me, smiling. "It's something the two of us have in common."
As we sat down at the table for dinner, I called Van, using my inside voice so no one at the table would know my attention was elsewhere. Van picked up.
"I'm busy," she said. I could barely hear her over the background noise.
"Where are you?" I asked.
"I'm in a bar, having a drink and trying to get laid," she said, "which means I'm busy."
"I know that Lucas Hubbard uses Nicholas Bell as an integrator."
"How do you know?"
"Because Hubbard is sitting across from me at the dinner table right now, using Bell."
"Well, shit," Van said. "That was easy."
"What should I do?"
"You're off the clock, Shane," Van said. "Do what you like."
"I thought you might be a little more excited," I said.
"When you see me tomorrow on the job, I will be excited," Van promised. "Right now, I'm otherwise occupied."
"Got it," I said,
Sorry to bother you. So am I, Van said. But since you did, I'll tell you I've made progress on our corpse. The DNA came back.
Who is he?
Don't know yet. I thought you said you made progress, I said.
I did. The DNA analysis didn't come up with anything, but it determined that he's probably of Navajo ancestry, which might explain why we can't find him in the database. If he's Navajo and lived on a reservation, then all his records would be on the reservation's databases. They're not automatically tied into the U.S. databases because the Navajo Nation is autonomous and strangely distrustful of the United States government.
Van fairly cackled at that last line.
How often does that happen, I asked. Even if you live on a reservation, if you ever leave it, you probably do something that gets you into our databases.
Maybe this guy never left, Van said. Until he left.
Do we have a request into them, I asked? The Navajo Nation, I mean.
Our forensics team does, yeah, Van said. DNA fingerprints and facial scan? The Navajo will get to it when they get to it. They don't always put a priority on our needs.
Up at the head of the table, Dad started clanging on his wine glass and then stood up.
Have to go, I said. My dad is about to make a speech.
Good, Van said. I was about to hang up on you anyway.
And then she did.
Dad's speech was his standard issue, at home with donors who everyone is pretending are friends speech, which is to say that it was light, familiar, casually intimate, yet at the same time it touched on themes important to the nation and to his not quite formally announced senatorial campaign. It went over like it usually does, which is to say very well, because Dad is Dad, and he's been doing the public relations thing since he was in high school. If you can't be charmed by Marcus Shane, you're probably a sociopath of some sort. But at the end of the speech, there was a switch-up from the text. Dad mentioned the challenges and opportunities that Abrams Kettering offers each of us, which I thought was a little out of context, since only I and Hubbard and Schwartz had Hayden's. So I cheated and did a quick facial scan of the other people at the table. Five of them were CEOs and or chairmen of companies that catered to the Hayden market one way or another, with all the businesses headquartered here in Virginia. That explained it then, and also why Dad was especially keen to have me at dinner, which meant, of course, that I was put on the spot.
And what do you think of Abrams Kettering, Chris?
One of the dinner guests asked me.
The facial scan registered him as Rick Wisson, the husband of Jim Buchold, the CEO of Loudon Pharma. Buchold, who was seated next to his husband, shot him a look, which Wisson either missed or ignored. I did not imagine their ride home that night would be especially pleasant.
I don't think it will be particularly surprising to you that my opinion closely matches my father's, I said, punting the conversational ball over to Dad, who naturally caught it easily.
What Chris is saying is that, as with most topics relating to Hayden's, we talk a lot about it as a family, he said. So what I end up saying is a result of long discussions between the three of us. Now, I think everyone knows that I was publicly opposed to Abrams Kettering. I still think it was the wrong solution to something that wasn't a problem. We know, as a group, Hayden's are contributing more to the national economy than they take out of it. But Abrams Kettering did pass, for better or worse, and now it's time to see how we make this new environment work for us.
That, I said, pointing down the table to my dad.
What do you think about the walkout and the march? Wisson asked.
Rick, Jim Buchold said as pleasantly as a snarl could be offered.
It's not out of line for dinner, Wisson said to his husband. Not for this dinner, anyway. And Chris here is an actual Hayden.
There's three of us at the table, actually, I said, nodding over to Hubbard and Schwartz.
With all due respect to Lucas and Mr. Schwartz, they're not exactly going to be affected by the changes in the law, Wisson said.
Hubbard and Schwartz both smiled thinly at this.
You, on the other hand, have a job and are out there on the street. You have to have some thoughts on it.
I think everyone has the right to their own opinion. And the right to peaceably assemble, I said. When in doubt, fall back on the First Amendment.
I worry about the peaceable part of it, said Carol Lamb down the table. She was one of the people for whom the valet was hired. She was old and crankily conservative in the way only old liberals could be. My daughter tells me the D.C. police are calling in their entire force this weekend. They're worried about rioting.
And why is that, Ms. Lamb? Sam Schwartz asked.
She said they're worried that the Haydens who are marching won't be scared of the police, Lamb said. Threeps aren't the same as human bodies.
Your daughter is worried about a robot uprising, I said. Lamb looked over at me and immediately blushed.
It's not that, she said hastily. It's just that this is the first mass Hayden protest.
It's different than any other protest.
Robot uprising, I said again, and then held up a hand before Lamb got even more flustered. Threeps aren't human bodies, no, but they're not Terminators either. The ones we use to get around on a daily basis are intentionally designed to be as much like the human body as possible in terms of strength, agility, and other factors. Because it's still a human running the Threep, Dad said.
Right, I said, and a human is going to use a machine scaled to natural human capabilities better than one that's not. I held up my hand. This is a machine hand attached to a machine arm, but it's rated for human power.
I'm not going to be able to flip this table in a rage. The marchers aren't going to be stomping down the mall tossing cars.
Threeps are still tougher than human bodies, Wesson noted. They can take a lot of damage.
Well, I said, I'll tell you a story. Mom and Dad will remember this one. When I was 8, I got a new bike for my birthday.
Oh, God, this story, Mom said.
And at the time, I had just found out about BMX stunts, I continued. So, one morning I made a ramp out on our driveway and was jumping off the thing, working up the courage to do a spin or something. I finally psyched myself up, pedaled as fast as I could, zoomed up the ramp, tried a spin, and flew ass over handlebar off the bike and into the road, right into the path of a panel truck doing 30. It hit me.
I really hate this story, Mom said.
Dad grinned. And I disintegrated, I said. The impact tore my threep apart. My head literally popped off and flew into the neighbor's bushes. I had no idea what happened. I had the feeling like I was shoved really hard and the world spun around, and then all of a sudden I was kicked back into my own body, wondering what the heck had just happened.
If that had been your human body, you would have been dead, Dad pointed out.
Yeah, I know, I said, which you or Mom mention every single time the story gets brought up. The point is, I turned back to Wisson, Threeps might be tougher than human bodies, but they can still get damaged. And Threeps aren't cheap. They cost the same as a car. Most people aren't going to want to let a cop whack on their Threep with a baton any more than they'd want a cop to use a baton on their fender. So I don't think we're going to have to worry about that robot uprising. The robots cost too much money for that.
What happened after the truck hit you? Schwartz asked.
Well, I was without a Threep for a while, I said, and there was laughter to that. And I think the driver of the moving truck threatened to sue Dad. He said I was at fault because I owned the Threep and the Threep came into his path and he had the right-of-way, Dad said.
He wouldn't have had a case, I said. Personal transports are a special class of machine under the law. Short of manslaughter, hitting a Threep with a truck carries the same penalties as hitting a human body.
Right, but I didn't want to have my name in the news over it, Dad said. So I bought him off, paid for the truck damage, and gave him floor tickets to the Wizards.
You've never given me floor tickets, Buchold said.
Don't get any ideas, Dad said, and everyone laughed again. Besides, Chris is an FBI agent these days. Now you'd get in trouble if you hit my kid with a truck.
The other thing I remember is that the next Threep I got was a real lemon, I said, and turned to Dad.
What model was it?
A Metro Junior Courier, Dad said. A really janky model.
Uh-oh, Hubbard said.
Accelerant owns Metro.
Well, then I said I blame you.
Fair enough, Hubbard said.
Although this was 20 years ago, right?
About, I said.
Then I didn't own it yet, Hubbard said. We bought it 18 years ago. No, 17.
17?
He turned to Schwartz, who looked surprised. Hubbard looked annoyed at his counsel, but then reached out to pat his hand reassuringly.
17, he said, finally. We bought it because the stock was depressed from a bad run of models,
including the courier and the junior courier.
I can believe it, I said. It was the last Metro model we ever bought.
They've gotten better, Hubbard said. I can send you over one of our latest if you'd like a test drive.